Hi, and welcome back to the Childhood Development Initiative's Restorative Practice podcast, where we talk all things RP. For this second season, we resume visiting communities and organisations to collect stories from practitioners around Ireland. We talk to young people, teachers, lecturers, youth and community workers, and restorative practices trainers to gather their insights on the impact of RP in their life and work. Each episode is focusing either on a place with several voices or on a practitioner. If you are not familiar with restorative practices, the restorative approach, the restorative questions, and the work CDI does, you can listen to the first episode of season one of our podcast series where it is all explained.
Hi, I'm Dorothy Danew, Restorative Practices Quality Specialist for CDI, and I'm delighted to be back on the road for the second season of Circles of Connection. For this episode, I went to Maynooth University to meet with Jan Marder, who is an assistant professor in criminology. We talked mostly about restorative and relational pedagogy and how he had embedded RP in his teaching. So, good morning, Jan. Thank you very much for agreeing to talking to us today. We are in your office in Maynooth University. It's a lovely place with a nice view on the ground. It's warm and cozy, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation. So please, could you introduce yourself? What is your role here in Maynooth?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dorothy. So I'm an assistant professor in criminology at Maynooth University in the School of Law and Criminology. And as a full-time academic here, we have a mix of responsibilities that include administration, teaching, and research. So in terms of my teaching, I teach policing for the second-year undergraduate criminologists. I teach victimology for the third-year undergraduate criminologists. And I teach restorative justice on the master's course. In terms of administration, I run the master's course, the MA in Comparative Criminology and Criminal Justice. And I'm also director of outreach and engagement for the school. And then finally, in terms of research, I have involved in various projects, mostly around restorative justice and restorative practices. Those include policy work, work with the prison service, with policing, but also I work in areas of research, including sentencing guidelines and in prisons.
Okay, so I know you are also very active in the field of promoting restorative justice. Could you briefly tell us about your work in this area before we focus on our topic for today?
Yeah, so the last job I had before coming here was for the Council of Europe, with whom I drafted the 2018 recommendation on restorative justice. And a lot of the work I've done since then has been around implementing that legal framework. So I work with the Department of Justice here, with the police, prisons, probation, and other people around implementing restorative justice and restorative practices in criminal justice. And that's part of a 10-country project called Restorative Justice Strategies for Change, where very similar work is being undertaken in several countries across Europe.
Okay, thank you very much. So today our conversation is about your practices as a lecturer in university and especially how you embedded restorative practice in your teaching. I actually believe you recently got an award for your teaching in Maynooth, so congratulations. Yeah, so in some of the podcasts last season, we heard a lot about teachers' practices in building relationship and resolving conflict in the classroom, mostly in primary and secondary school. So we also heard about school implementation, but not so much about the impact it has on pedagogy and teaching practices, and especially in your context, which is third level education. So, yeah, really, it's how are RP embedded in your teaching and how does it look like to take a module with you?
Yeah, third level education has some really interesting, really unique dynamics. I remember recently I was asked to teach some introductory criminology sessions in a high school in Dublin, and I was a little bit worried in advance that, you know, maybe the group wouldn't want to participate and they'd be a bit quiet. And that was a totally false assumption because it was quite the reverse. Actually, people in the class were very much up for having a conversation, very much up for working together, speaking in front of each other. And what that really brought home to me was that the pedagogical approaches we use in higher education are actually particularly non-dialogic, can be particularly non-participatory and non-relational. And of course, most of our teaching is focused around the lecture. And the lecture is something where traditionally you go up and you talk for 50 minutes or an hour and 50 minutes. They listen and take notes. And there's really not great research to suggest that that's a particularly useful way of imparting knowledge or of doing education, because it's really passive and you know, people struggle to concentrate and so on. So my, I think, teaching practice totally changed when I received training in restorative practices myself. I'd always been a researcher in the field of restorative justice, and indeed I'd received, you know, restorative justice conferencing training. But when I received training in circles, really, that's when I thought, okay, I can bring this into my own teaching practices, because what restorative practice teaches us is that this is something we can do across the public sector. It doesn't matter if you're a judge or a social worker, police officer, prison officer, teacher, or indeed an academic. If you are working with people for whose welfare you're responsible and over whom you have authority, you can work with them rather than doing things to or for them. So thanks for mentioning the award. Very kind of you to do that. I mean, that was particularly for some work I do with the Masters in Criminology program, where I run a sustained restorative dialogue. And what I mean by that is I bring together all the staff and students on a voluntary basis, at least once a month over the course of the year. And the purpose of that is, you know, very straightforward. It's just to have space to get to know each other, to get used to talking in front of each other, really, really very basic, sometimes quite trite relational stuff. Show each other pictures on your phone that tell stories about you. What would you have done if you were not doing criminology? You know, tell us about something you're looking forward to this summer, favorite meal ever, really basic relational stuff using circles. And we're currently evaluating that. So we have 1 year of interview data with staff and students. We're about to collect a second year of interview data. Anecdotally, it seems like it's very, very useful. The first round of interview data suggested that it was quite useful, and I think it's really important to dedicate that space to relational work, to build the group cohesion that then permits the task of education to take place successfully.
And so that's out of the classes. So are there practices, are there things that you do, you know, during what's is supposed to be lectures. Do you do lectures or do you do things a bit differently?
Yeah, exactly. That's outside of class time. Within lectures, I suppose I also dedicate time for relational work. I dedicate time for reflection. I dedicate time for dialogue in the sense that I regularly build in, you know, a very normal teaching method is pair and share, but I do a lot of that. You know, I say, what do you think about that? Talk to people near you, except I sometimes ask them to do a circle in that situation. And also, you know, aligning with restorative values, I ask them to talk about how things make them feel and to reflect on that and then to share that with the room. And I build in, you know, I'm not sure how successful this is, but I try and build comedy into it because my interpretation of the literature is that, you know, being funny is similar to being vulnerable and, you know, you can build relationships. It's very humanizing. You know, I think academia suffers from the same problem or the same risk of any public sector organization, which is that you as a professional are dehumanized to your citizens and the citizens are dehumanized to you. So I think it's about intentionally being very human, being vulnerable, talking about how you're feeling, you know, not necessarily changing your behavior, particularly when you're in front of students or when you're not in front of students.
Yeah, I think I remember during the pandemic, you bringing a goat into a Zoom.
Brought a goat into a Zoom. Now, I wasn't with the goat, but what I saw was this, you know, this farm in either here or in England, I can't remember now, which, you know, diversifying their commercial opportunities. You can pay 10 euro for 5 minutes Zoom with a goat. So yeah, bring the goat in to the lecture, you know, why not? Like a little bit of crack for them. And, you know, I think what's really important in higher education is that we can feel very, very under pressure to communicate as much information as possible and to absolutely pack our lectures full of, you know, effectively lists of information. And that's something I'm very susceptible to. You know, naturally, I would have lecture slides. There are just dozens of slides, tons of text. And, you know, that's just, first of all, that's not very humane, really. It's not really aligning with, you know, what good education looks like. But also, it's not recognizing the importance of the culture, the social culture of the room, the relationship of you and the students to each other. It's not recognizing the importance of that as a thing that can facilitate the education, the task that we're doing, which is education. So I try and cut back my stuff as much as possible in a way that means I can try and build in a bit of space. Like, there's nothing that I'm going to omit that's so desperately important to my courses that it's worth blasting it all at them rather than spending at least a bit of time on the relational side of things and on the dialogic side of things. Because you can see, you know, when I ask them to do pair and share, like, that's obviously time when I'm not giving them new content. But you can really see they're learning from each other as much as they're learning from me and hearing things from many voices. And again, this is what the research suggests good education looks like.
Are students involved in the content, in having some input on the content, on the choice, not on the content? Like, you have, you're giving the knowledge. Well, they also have knowledge, but in a restorative way, with this idea of participation and collaboration, do you have room for that? Are you able to discuss a bit, you know, what you're going to teach, staying in your field, of course, and in what you need to teach?
So I think another interesting dynamic of higher education is that we have, in many courses, almost total discretion over what we teach. Now, of course, in law, and there are other courses that are like a professional qualification and you have to teach certain things. But in criminology is an applied social science. We could have a whole degree called criminology that was very legalistic. We could have a whole degree called criminology that was very sociological. And when I teach policing for undergrads or victimology for undergrads, you could have two courses that look totally different but are equally suitable to teaching the content of those topics. So I do try and involve students in co-creation in a number of ways. The one project I want to mention was something that we published last year in the Journal of Criminal Justice Education, where after the victimology course was taught for the first time, we got a small amount of funding to involve students in reflecting on and really revising that whole course. And so we hired 4 of the 70 students to record data involving another 30 or so students in focus groups. And then the 4 that we hired as research assistants not only recorded and organized the data collected in the focus groups, but also then took that and went through a design process to produce a number of changes that could be made. And we came up with 20 changes I could make to the module. And also, I've managed to implement those across my other modules. But what's really interesting is that almost none of them, in fact, basically none of them, were about the content. They were about the students' emotional relationship with the course, with the university, and with the way in which I was teaching things. So I didn't have to change the content as such for them to say to me, you always go over time, so you have to cut some stuff back. Or when I look at these slides later for the exam, it's not obvious to me which ones are for this or which ones are for that. Or the guest lectures you brought in were great, but they didn't align as well with the content. Or we have lots of questions, and maybe if there was an FAQ, you know, you wouldn't get the same question so many times. So we did co-create all sorts of things with those students. Those students ended up writing an FAQ. We ended up recording a video with them on researching for assessments. So what I found was really, really interesting, because I expected them to say, well, this topic was really interesting and this topic was really boring. And the topics really basically never came up. I think there's a really important lesson for that in terms of what's important to citizens is the way that we deliver services, but also we as professionals might think we're really smart and knowledgeable about the topics. And obviously we are. You know, I know about victimology more than they do because I've taught it for years and I research in the area. But I don't know what changes I need to make to meet their needs. I simply don't know that. I have no way of predicting that unless I ask them. And then I suppose, you know, aside from that day to day, there is stuff that I do to try and involve students in co-creation, including, for example, I seek students' input on the assessments. I publish drafts of that before we publish the final thing. And I say, come and tell me if you want something different, if a word is not clear. And I have made, you know, usually quite marginal changes as a result of that, but changes nonetheless. And also, I think there's a procedural reason for that rather than just a substantive reason, because a substantive reason would be maybe I should change it. The procedural reason is he cares what we think. And I think there's something really important in that.
Yeah, especially in the process of assessing, which is can very easily be something that you do to people. How do you navigate that? Because there is still that you still have the role of assessing them and telling them at the end of the year if they're passing or failing. So how can this be done in a restorative way?
Yeah, assessment is by far the most miserable part of university for students and for academics. So, I mean, there's something really important about that insight is, you know, to one extent, there's only so much you can do about that. But then, you know, where are the pressure points? Where are the really low times? How can we make it a bit less miserable, if nothing else? So as I say, I wrote with students, and in fact, they led on writing this, an FAQ. I append that to every single assessment that I publish for the students, and tons of information is in there. That idea came from students, it was written by students, and, you know, for me, and what I would say to my colleagues is, it's really useful for me, because I don't get the questions that are answered there, at least as much as I would have done otherwise. The other thing is that I build in assessment support time and feedback time into the classes. So for every module, there's time built into the course where I present the draft assessment, I get feedback, I'm really clear about my expectations. I think that's a really important element of restorative practice as well, that expectation clarity, the fair process. So, you know, even if it still feels harmful, maybe that's unavoidable. Like, I mean, even in policing, like, you can arrest someone in a way that is more restorative or not, but that doesn't change the fact that it causes harm. It just means that it might cause less harm, and it might cause less harm to the relationship between the citizen and the service provider.
Does it happen sometimes yet that you have to actually have restorative conversation, or like the more kind of reactive part of restorative practices? I suppose with the way you are promoting healthy relationships, it's probably preventive of conflicts, but do you have experience of that?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I suppose the fact that I intentionally build relationships with the students probably leads to me having more restorative conversations than I would have done otherwise, because people come to me with their problems when they might not have done otherwise. So, you know, despite not being in charge of the undergrad course, policing, the module that I teach is a second year compulsory undergraduate module. And after the students finish that module, tons of them still come to me with issues that they're having. And mostly it's personal stuff, you know, stuff that is not necessarily a conflict, stuff that is not necessarily anything we can do apart from listen and signpost. But nonetheless, I use the restorative questions in one-on-one support, you know, just for people, you know, it helps people to express themselves, shows that you care, ask people what they think they need. And usually it's just listening. Sometimes it's information. But that's one situation where I use a restorative conversation, is in one-on-one support, where it's not necessarily a conflict or an interpersonal harm issue. And, you know, I have hundreds of students, like every possible combination of bad things that could happen to someone will happen to our students. And it just depends whether we know about it or not. Because if we know about it, we can help them decide how best to have their needs met in a way that, and maybe that means that they defer for a year. you know, when stuff is really bad, or maybe it means that we can refer them to other services. But if we don't know, there's definitely nothing we can do to help. So we really need them to trust us in such a way that they come to us before it's too late for us to do anything for them. And we're very flexible here. Like if people have some serious issue and they need a block extension on everything, like we basically just give that to them, you know, like, and it's very interesting that despite everything we do, people are still intimidated by us. You know, this is the nature of, I think, public sector services and citizens, is people are still intimidated by the nicest police officers, the nicest academics. Like, they think we're going to be harsh, even when we're trying to be as clear as possible that, look, please come to us and we'll help you. But the other area that I do have reactive, restorative conversations is around plagiarism. So we have, you know, by virtue of the fact that I have hundreds and hundreds of assessments every year, I also have, you know, a usually low two-digit number of cases that could be accused of some sort of academic malpractice. And usually what that is they've copied and pasted some stuff over and they meant to change it, but they were in a rush, so they didn't, or they didn't realize that the extent to which they had done that, you know, necessarily met some sort of threshold that we would see. So what's interesting is that I actually have a very low threshold, I think, compared to my colleagues for when I will pick someone up on that. But I have a very, very high threshold for when I would refer that in to, you know, the adversarial or punitive system. And I deal with almost every single case of plagiarism or plagiarism-like issues that come to me. I will deal with that through restorative conversation. And I ask them how they're getting on. You know, I use the restorative questions. I say to them things like, you know, sometimes this is because people are in a rush and maybe there's a problem. How are you doing? Is everything okay? And often they're like, look, I'm working full time. I didn't have time. I didn't get organized. And sometimes it's really, really bad. Sometimes they're having a really bad situation and we wouldn't have known about it, you know, were it not for the fact that they're telling me in this situation. And I ask them what they think needs to happen next. And usually they're way more punitive to themselves than I was going to be. They're like, oh, well, I guess I should get zero on this. And I was like, well, I was thinking maybe dock you like 5 points or something like that. And then I ask them if they think I've been fair, and they always say yes, and they're grateful. They're like, thank you so much for this. I'm like, I just disciplined you in theory, right? But the way that you do it makes them extremely grateful for the plagiarism meeting that you've just had with them. And the other thing that I do, that I offer every time, is, can I check in with you in 3 months from now and see how you're getting on? And again, this is anecdotal and I would like to evaluate this, but anecdotally, the information I get back from them is that often they are able to implement things like getting more organized, starting assessments earlier, coming to more lectures, the kind of things that we talk about that could help them. They tell me that they're able to do that and they wouldn't have done that otherwise had I not had that conversation with them.
Yeah, so it's actually really addressing the issue.
Right.
Yeah, for them, and making the situation much better for everybody.
Yeah, right.
It's really positive outcomes. I know you're also, I think you're also involved in a network of academics trying to promote the use of restorative mindsets and practices in a third level. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so this is the Restorative Justice Pedagogy Network. And that is about, mostly it is about teaching restorative justice. And so it was originally, you know, a group of academics from around the world who either have a course on restorative justice, and that could be in a law program, criminology, social work, education, any type of program in social sciences anyway. And over time, you know, that did turn a little bit into using restorative practices in the teaching of restorative justice. So for example, we held a workshop online, Restorative Approaches to Restorative Justice Assessments. But we've also held workshops on, for example, different kinds of restorative justice courses, because you could teach a course on restorative justice, which is very theory heavy, or you could teach one that's very skills heavy, or a kind of an empirical social science one that's about the research on restorative justice and the impact on victims and offenders and so on. So we combine meetings and discussions on content and on what you deliver in restorative justice courses with how do you do that in a restorative way. And so, for example, we also had a workshop on using circles in restorative justice classrooms, where we heard from a few speakers that did various approaches to participation, one who used Lego, one who used mindfulness, people who used circles, really, really interesting, innovative pedagogical things. And then the final part of that session was that we co-created a set of slides that could then be training people who are not restorative justice experts to use circles in their own courses. And so we also now have, and this was in collaboration with Vermont Law School and York St. John, we have a recording, which is effectively a short training course for how to, in a very low stakes way, build circles into higher education classrooms. And we suggest that the people who use that might be people who teach restorative justice, so they're very aware of it, but maybe they're not trained in restorative practices, or alternatively, people who teach other things, but maybe one of their colleagues uses restorative practices and they've witnessed it. Like, it's not a proper training course, you know? You need to already have some exposure to it, even, we argue, to pick up this kind of short training exercise and then go and use it yourself, albeit in a very low-stakes way. You know, again, start your course with a circle, asking everyone what they've been up to, you know, or use a circle to talk about the reading. So really low stakes, but giving everyone that chance to speak and breaking this dynamic that always exists in higher education classrooms where some people dominate the conversation. You know, if I ask a room of 50 people, what do you think? The same people will always answer because it's not structured. You know, the whole point of circles is you structure it in a more equitable way, because it's not like everyone doesn't have a thought or everyone doesn't have the right to have their thoughts heard. Or even it's not that the dominating people are being malicious, right? It's just that they're the ones who can hack the silence least. Like, that would be me. That would be me. If someone asks a question, it's something obvious. Everyone in the room knows the answer. Everyone's silent. I'll just put my hand up. And that can happen 6 or 7 times in a 1 hour session. Yeah, we have over 250 people from, I think, about 45 countries right now from all over the world. We hosted the first in-person meeting here at Maynooth University, and the topic we chose for that was communicating restorative justice to the public. And the reason we chose that topic was because, on one hand, there's pedagogical and educational elements to that. How do you communicate restorative justice? But also it aligns with our research interests, because most of us are actively involved in trying to develop restorative justice and criminal justice in practice. And so we thought that would be a good topic. And we had a 3-day workshop in collaboration with the Maynooth Innovation Lab, who facilitated and, in fairness to them, funded it. And so we had, I think, 28 people from 18 countries or something like that come to Maynooth, all funded, to talk about communicating restorative justice to the public.
Maybe to close this conversation, do you have a highlight, like really a story that stayed with you in terms of your experience as being a restorative teacher, or a restorative lecturer?
Yeah, so one of the first times I used a circle in the classroom, I was teaching tutorials at my previous university. So there's maybe about 10 people in the room, and I'm teaching the same topic 5 times to groups of 10 or 12 people. And I was quite worried that, you know, I'm bringing in the talking piece, the chairs are set up in a circle when they get there. Now, this was a group I already knew because I taught them in their second year a bit of restorative justice. And then in their kind of sentencing module in final year, they had one lecture and one tutorial on restorative justice and serious crime. So I guess they already kind of knew me, but when they came in the room, they were like, oh God, what's he doing here? And it occurred to me that I should as part of this, asked them how they found the circle process. So we used circles to talk about their attitudes towards restorative justice and serious crime, to reflect on, you know, how it might make a victim feel, how it might make an offender feel, you know, how they would feel if they were asked to facilitate that as a criminal justice professional, some of the barriers to it, and so on. And the last question I ask is, how did you find the circle process? And certainly everyone, 100% positive feedback every single time. People who said things like, I thought I would pass, but you don't pass because you just say what you think, so it's fine. And one person in particular said, as we were going around at the end, I remember he said, I found it really, really hard because I really wanted to jump in and respond to something that someone said. But by the time it got around to me, I'd changed my mind anyway. And I thought that was really, really interesting in terms of the benefits of the structure, the benefits of them hearing from each other, and just the speaking and the listening and the importance of that in higher education. And that person probably would not have changed their mind about this topic had it not been for the circle.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much for your time and your best of luck with the rest of the year.
Thank you, Dorothy. Much appreciated.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed our podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to our show.